Today we are going to have an informational hearing and discussion on international remittances that are leaving our airport. Over the last 2 years, more than $700,000 has left the state of Minnesota in suitcases and airplanes, heading to parts that we will learn more about around the globe. But first, I would like to welcome Representative Pam Altendorf, who has joined our committee. We are appreciative of your service and look forward to your contributions on the committee.
Thank you.
Next, we are going to approve the minutes of March 9th, 2026. Representative Schultz, have you reviewed the minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have reviewed the minutes, and I move their adoption.
Excellent. Are there any questions or changes to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. All right. Before we invite our witnesses to the testifying table, I just wanted to give the public a little bit of understanding of why we're having this hearing and why it's a little bit outside of our wheelhouse. In a lot of it has to do with federal policy. But this is one of the things that I get the most questions about. One of two things I get the most questions about when I'm in my district and around the state. And people say, we hear all these reports of money leaving the airport. Why doesn't the state stop this? And I think it's really important for the public and us as members to understand the different roles and lanes at the airport, who has jurisdiction over what, and the role between the state Financial Crimes Task Force and the federal government, Department of Treasury. There's a lot of things that we can do together, but there's a lot of this that resides with our federal partners. And so I just wanted to make sure that we're having a clear conversation for our understanding as legislators and potential things we can do, but also for our federal partners and things that we will need their help on. And then just, again, for the general public, who is incredibly frustrated about the stories they hear, the reports they hear, and that nothing seems to be getting done. So just as a level set, I want to remind everyone that the story of child care fraud back from, like, the 2015, 2018, 2019 period is when we first learned about suitcases of cash leaving the airport. And that was presented by a whistleblower in testimony in the Minnesota Senate, as well as to the Office of Legislative Auditor. And I would say the report from the Legislative Auditor in March and April of 2019 said that it couldn't be substantiated. And so people, I think, roundly thought at that time that it maybe had stopped. There had been some child care fraud prosecutions at that time. The estimate at that time publicly was $100 million leaving the airport. And people thought, well, you know, maybe that was overblown. And honestly, myself as a legislator and as a citizen at that time, I really thought when the issue faded from the news that it probably hadn't stopped. And I was shocked in January of 2026, just 2 months ago, to see a TSA bulletin saying that, no, in fact, it had tripled. So in 2024, $343 million left the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport in cash. In 2025, that number had grown to $350 million. And TSA put out an alert, and that also put the Department of Treasury into action. But that was a shocking number, and I think that's what really galvanized the public on this issue. And for context, we have the 16th largest airport. That number, $350 million leaving our airport in cash, is higher than the cash leaving any other airport in the country, including much larger airports, JFK, LAX, Chicago, O'Hare. So we are an outlier as a state in terms of the amount of cash leaving our airport. And so that is why we're having this hearing, to better understand what is going on, not only at the airport, but where those funds are coming from, and are any of them tied to the fraud here in Minnesota, because that has been a big concern. And I know my colleagues are going to say, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but I know skeptics are saying that, oh, this was never tied to fraud and this was never tied to terrorism. And I just want to point everyone to an article in your packet that's also available online for the public who wants to read it. But this is back from 2000 members from the Star Tribune. And at that time, they were saying there were $75 million in cash leaving MSP. And they talked specifically in this article about how, quote, there were organized collection systems in Minnesota to pressure Somalis into contributing small sums for guns and clan-based militias back home. And people who ran the money transfers at that time said, quote, Somali immigrants were told the contributions are for war, guns, ammunition, gas for tanks, and food for soldiers. And many people were concerned about this. And many people in the Somali community decided not to contribute anymore because they did not want to be supporting warlords and the violence back home. But there were people who were called collectors, we'll talk more about that later, who were going around and getting this money and sending it back home, as reported in the Star Tribune back in 2000. So this is not a new issue. And then subsequent in other articles we have in the packets, there were convictions for two women who were using the Hawala networks to funnel money to terrorism. They were convicted. And there's as recently as 2024, there was a Hawala near the Carmel Mall that was used to collect the money to pay the juror for the bribe in the Feeding Our Future case. So this is not new. This has been going on in our state for decades. And so it's incumbent on us to understand the issue, to learn from our federal partners what their jurisdiction is, what's the jurisdiction of the state, and to think together how we can do better to address this issue. So with that, I would like to invite our first testifier up. So we have, so our first testifier is Matt Christensen, Chief of Police from the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and Jason Erickson, Lieutenant of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. And we very much appreciate your coming and explaining to us and the public your role, and look forward to your testimony. Good morning. So please state your name for the record and then begin your testimony.
Yeah, good morning, Chair Robbins and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I am Matt Christensen, the Chief of Police for the Metropolitan Airports Commission. I am joined by Deputy Chief Jason Erickson. We were invited to provide clarity regarding the jurisdictional lines of authority, federal and local, at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport and how those authorities relate to individuals traveling with large sums of money, as has been recently reported in the news. The Airport Police Department is a local law enforcement agency similar to police departments in any Minnesota community. We enforce Minnesota state laws and ordinances of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. In addition, all commercial airports are required by federal law to maintain an aviation security program regulated by the Transportation Security Administration. This program governs such areas as perimeter security, employee access control, and at Minneapolis, those responsibilities fall to the Airport Police Department. The Transportation Security Administration, beyond its regulatory role of the airport, is responsible for screening passengers and their luggage. The Customs and Border Protection has jurisdiction over all individuals and their property entering and leaving the United States. So this is the legal framework that applies when an individual is traveling with cash. Federal law regulates the international movement of currency in excess of $10,000. Travelers carrying more than that amount are required to disclose it to Customs and Border Protection and complete the appropriate documentation, which I believe you're aware of. It's the FinCEN 105, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Networks form. That regulates the international currency movement. That is all a federal responsibility. The Airport Police Department has been aware of the activity and has been informed and informed federal law enforcement and the U.S. Attorney's Office all along that the activity is being conducted, and their response is it is being conducted legally under federal law. thank you for your time today. I hope that provides a little clarity as far as a local law enforcement officer's job and my department's job at the MSP International Airport. We are happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. I don't know, do we want to do questions now or go through the witnesses and then have questions? Okay, I think we'll go on to the next witnesses, and then, so if you can just stay close, and then we'll probably have you back up. Thank you.
Thank you.
So next we have a testifier by Zoom. So are you, so?
She's here.
So this testifier has asked to remain anonymous, and we've agreed with our friends from the DFL that that was okay.
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of what you're talking about. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Do you know who you spoke with about
I
that?
I think Lori and Benji agreed that she would remain anonymous.
Oh, that we had agreed to remain anonymous? I don't want to put my staff on. Yeah, that's not, I don't believe that my staff, that's not something that we had.
You may have
said that one was going to be anonymous. I guess that didn't, I didn't want you to think we were agreeing with. I was not really aware of that, and was not not necessarily agreeing to it. I mean, obviously you're the chair. I had not really thought before. Now I've never heard of an anonymous witness, so I'm sorry.
Yes. Well, we did check with nonpartisan as well, and
it
is acceptable. And we thought we had agreement. I apologize if we didn't, but she will be anonymous because we are protecting our whistleblowers. So. So with that, I would like to welcome the testifier to the committee. Please begin your testimony.
Good morning, all. I'm honored to be invited to participate in this fraud prevention event today. Thank you. However, I'm not willing to take another risk of visually participating today since my story has already been told. I have previously spoken with award-winning investigative reporter Liz Collin of Alpha News concerning this mind-boggling fraud, where I witnessed firsthand millions of dollars of Minnesota taxpayers' cash being curried exclusively by Savalis through the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. Again, I'm coming forward as I would hope I am speaking for all the whistleblowers put at risk and Minnesota taxpayers that this fraud is an absolute travesty of justice, where to date nothing has been done, not one resignation, not one deportation, not one arrest, not one person jailed. Where what else and who else can finally and safely keep this story front and center until justice is finally served? Godspeed to this committee and your work. Thank you very much, and amen.
Thank you, and I hope you will stay online to answer any questions we may have after the next testifier.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Our next testifier is Scott Stillman, former retired DHS employee.
Thank you, Chair Robbins.
Good morning.
For having me here today.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Scott Stillman, and I have a brief statement that I'd like to say. I'd like to lay out a brief outline of why I'm here today, how I got to this point. Can you all hear me okay? Okay. My background is in law enforcement as a white-collar fraud investigator. I also worked in the private sector, and I've received training in many areas, including 5 advanced courses in investigative topics at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. In 2007, I was hired at DHS, and I was later promoted to be the supervisor of the DHS's forensics lab. In approximately 2011, I was informed DHS was receiving reports from citizens about daycare frauds. Because of this, my job duties expanded to include daycare, Medicaid, and Medicare fraud investigations. In approximately 2015, I became concerned about what I was seeing in the digital evidence I analyzed, and I began providing verbal warnings to, I'm just gonna use a redacted because I don't have the ability to get an attorney to protect me here, so I'm just gonna not name names. In 2016, DHS and I were served with an unrelated tort and defamation lawsuit. On March 13, 2017, I mailed, redacted, my concerns about the daycare fraud. Drafting my concerns in an email was fraught with risk, but I had been verbally warning DHS senior managers repeatedly over the last year, but their responses consisted of inaction or the excuse that it was impossible to detect and fight frauds involving collusion. On March 28, 2017, I emailed, redacted again about fraud concerns, including what I described as a systemic problem at DHS of fraud and lack of controls to prevent fraud. Meanwhile, the lawsuit was progressing. The Attorney General lawyers asked me about work I had conducted for another state agency. The AG lawyers reported they received information in discovery about a possible issue causing them great concern. I told the lawyers in an email the case they were concerned about was something DHS senior staff above me had conducted. Conducting work as a DHS employee for a company that held contracts with DHS was against policy, was potentially illegal. On May 5th, 2017, Redacted entered the digital forensics lab with the hard drive from his DHS computer. He instructed one of my staff to erase the drive in his presence. That hard drive was under the lawsuit preservation order at the time. In June of 2017, DHS and AG lawyers informed me the lawsuit required me to sign a plea agreement stating I had made false statements. This was less than 3 months after I wrote my whistleblower emails about daycare fraud and possible national security issues. Prior to this, I was told the lawsuit was weak and I had nothing to worry about. The settlement DHS and the AG proposed required me to admit to things I did not do. I refused to sign it and pointed out to the AG attorneys that they did not interview key witnesses about a relevant contract issue. When I pressed them on this, they moved ahead to interview only two of three witnesses, concluding there was no proof the contract matter occurred. I later told my business attorney about this finding, and he was astonished, stating the lawsuit's discovery located emails about the contract issue. Nevertheless, I was told I was required to sign the lawsuit statement. I refused. This back and forth continued for about 2 weeks, but the AG lawyer sat me down in a conference room where they said, number one, you are required to sign this plea agreement. Number two, we know you did not do these things, but we don't care. Number three, if you do not sign the plea agreement, DHS will settle their portion of the lawsuit, pull all my legal representation, leaving me with all of the obligations of the lawsuit, and DHS would testify against me. Number four, this plea agreement is in the best interest of the state. Number five, we think you will survive this. DHS and the AG abruptly changed course after I wrote that whistleblower emails exposed my flank, and it forced me under duress to sign a plea agreement destroying my credibility. They wore me down, and eventually I felt I had no choice but to sign the settlement. After the settlement meeting, the AG lawyers told me they found something in discovery that would hurt the state, and they needed to settle to protect the state. This was the second time they told me this. In January 2020, DHS mailed me copies of the emails related to the lawsuit. In that mailing was a letter from DHS saying I was prevented from disclosing the contents of the emails to anyone. That requirement from DHS prevents me from disclosing the DH emails I have that include my protests to settling the lawsuit, showing you exculpatory evidence, or disclosing information clearing my conduct. On December 22, 2017, my supervisor informed me HR had removed my supervisory status. I took the rest of the day off and resigned the following day. It is my belief DHS used their positions, knowledge, and immense power to force a settlement on me for two purposes. Save senior entities, state entities, from the liabilities of the lawsuit, and two, destroy my credibility in light of the issues I brought up in my March 2017 emails. The end result was I was smeared with the label of a liar. I lost my job, my career, my business, and my reputation. Possibly the biggest fraud perpetrated against the citizens of Minnesota wasn't necessarily the theft of public funds. It was how the government ignored and covered up my findings, hiding the truth from the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stillman. So I think since you're at the witness table, I'll start with questions for you, and maybe others have them as well. So my first question is, the emails you referenced, are they still, I know you cannot disclose them, but do they still exist to your knowledge?
The emails regarding my lawsuit, yes, I have copies of those, yes.
Right, but you can't disclose them. Do they still exist sort of in DHS world that you're aware of?
If they, I'm fairly certain they would. I'm not 100% certain, but if they did, they'd be in their legal servers.
Okay. So could you go back, and I would like to drill down more on your work as at the forensics lab. So my understanding is that DHS, at that time when the child care fraud first came up, that you, at the forensics lab, as part of a DHS criminal investigative unit that was larger than the forensic lab, there were other people involved, that you did look at wire transfers. I've spoken to another source who had particularly worked on the wire transfer issue, as well as people who were involved at that time in looking at the role of the Hawalas. And my understanding from your work and their work is that if you could just sort of describe, like, they would set up surveillance at these daycares. They had subpoenas for cell phones and computers and were doing forensic analysis. Can you explain what the scope of the work was at that time at DHS when there was criminal investigations going on?
The scope was enormous. We were doing search warrants. At one point, we were doing 2 search warrants a week. We would do search warrants all over Minnesota, but primarily in Minneapolis, Ramsey County, Hennepin County. The Office of Inspector General, OIG, I think that you're referencing, was run by a retired State Patrol captain, highly acclaimed, highly respected captain, and he managed most of the investigations. He had a list on the wall of his office listing all of the daycares that he had received information about relevant fraud. He collected most of the top ones, nothing under $1 million. And I can't recall how many were on that list. I want to say there were 100. I can't swear that. It was a long list. And he had the names of the daycares and the dollar amounts of frauds. And that tallied roughly $100 million. And that was his estimation based on the fraud. He and his staff would conduct investigations, interviews. They would set up surveillance cameras around the suspected daycare that were committing the fraud. They would watch the businesses for, on average, 3 months to record who came and went. I helped them with some of the technical issues on that surveillance system and how to analyze it a little more quickly. My job was, when they set up a search warrant, I would go with, I would grab the computers, the laptops, the cell phones, the servers, the networks, the video surveillance systems, and anything else that we found. And then we would take that back to the lab where we would analyze it. Most of the evidence we found was in the cell phones. Some of it we had to get translated, but in the cell phones I would see apps, overseas company apps for transferring money. I would see wire transfers. There would be comments and things of that nature. And that evidence, by the way, still exists. It's at the DHS forensics lab evidence room where I stored it. It's still there. All of it is. My emails, the evidence I'm talking about, wire frauds, all the issues. I've got some emails here regarding our concerns about terrorism and funding. All the evidence for that, all the proof for that exists at the DHS lab. Some of it exists at the Office of Legislative Auditors as well.
Thank you. So could you describe the nexus of our committee is that some money was stolen for fraud, and then some of that fraudulently obtained money was transferred through bank accounts or shell companies to places through the Hawala network overseas. And that's the point at which, you know, according to our colleagues in the federal government and others, we lose sight of where the money goes, but because some of it is going to regions controlled by al-Shabaab in Somalia and other places. They expect that at a minimum, some of it was directly funding terrorism, as we have those court cases from 2012. But by far, it seems like the most indirect route is that when money is sent overseas, they take that terrorist organizations take a cut of it. So can you explain on this side of the money transfer how the shell companies worked, how the money transfers worked, what you were looking for? And because the concern for us is once it leaves the country in suitcases, we don't get it back. So how do we spot that on the front end? And what were you looking for? And are those, now that the criminal investigation unit at DHS is no longer functioning, who does that work?
When we would do the preliminary intelligence analysis on these businesses, we would see if they were registered with the state as a corporation or LLC, and we would track the owners. And we found that the ownership would change, sometimes monthly, so that 1 month there'd be one board and another, making it very difficult to track and prove ownership. The shell companies, which are basically a fraudulent company, a non-existent company that was just used on paper to start a business.
I'm sorry, can you speak a little closer to the mic?
Thank you. The shell companies, which were just fraudulent or non-existent companies that were used to collect money for a business. But we found, or what the OIG's team found, was DHS's computer systems paid these companies typically at 3 o'clock in the morning. It was an automatic bank transfer. And from there on, the bank fraud investigator that was looking at these transactions, he would see that these transactions would go into their business account, and then within seconds it would be transferred to another account. And then seconds of that, it would be transferred into another account. And seconds of that, it would be transferred into another account. It would go through 50 different bank accounts around the world and usually end up in the United Arab Emirates or Dubai, which once it got there, banking laws and U.S. laws don't apply. So it goes into an area that can't be tracked for the most part. Now, there was a case, one of the first cases I worked on, which was the Salama case. It was an enormous case. I think I got that from Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and it's been a few years, but I think it was 100 computers, phones, servers, and it was enormous. And I uncovered Excel spreadsheets in that trove of evidence. Now DHS was paying that company, Salama, through their computer system, but this company, and I believe it's possible this was the precursor to feeding our fraud, this company would pay another company, a restaurant in Minneapolis, to provide food for the children. And that restaurant, if memory serves me correctly, was involved with recruiting young people to join al-Shabaab. I had the spreadsheet showing thousands of dollars being funneled directly to that restaurant. And from there, it can be transported into cash. And what they do with it from there is a little different. Now, I went into one business on another search warrant in South Minneapolis and immediately encountered the owner. And the gentleman it wasn't a suitcase, it was a duffel bag. And it was roughly 2 to 3 feet long, foot wide, foot high. It was full of cash, and I was curious about it, and he said, well, I'm a member of the Hawala. I'm on my way to the airport right now, and I'm going to take this cash overseas, and he was very open about it, and so I've seen some of the money going through Hawala. It was astonishing to see the different ways that this could be done. Now, I don't know if this answers your question, but I have an email here that may give a little bit light on that. Jay Swanson, the member of the OIG, the manager there, and this is an email I got from the Freedom of Information Act, and it's dated April 30th, 2015. And it says, and we were trying to get some computer logs. They're called Internet Protocol logs, IP logs. So just to give you some background, it's like when the post office delivers a letter, it goes to an address from, it goes from like Texas to Minneapolis, and they have to find out where it goes to, so there's a zip code, there's a city, a street address, and a house address. That's what an IP log is in the computer system. So we were trying to find that because this individual who was associated with, I believe, Salama, had a laptop, and she was back and forth overseas all the time. And there were some concerns, and I'll just give you a brief summary of it here. Jay's writing to the Minute Technical System. He says, to shed some light on the importance of these types of cases, this provider is believed to have overbilled DHS and the Child Care Assistance Program in excess of $1 million in calendar year 2014, with overbilling continuing at the same rate for calendar year 2015. To make matters worse, we have seen evidence that very quickly after the DHS funds are electronically deposited in the account of the Child Care Center owner, they are quickly wired to other accounts in the Middle East. We have reason to believe those funds are a means of financing for one or more terrorist organizations. Just to be clear, while this case is our most pressing, we have a number of others just like this of the same magnitude that will be coming up upcoming months. It is vital to our investigations. So DHS paid these daycares through, I believe it was the MEC squared billing system. And we discovered when we wanted to find out who was billing and where they were billing from, that the MEC squared system was not designed to include IP numbers. It's a major oversight. It'd be like buying a brand new car that didn't have brakes. It's a basic in computer systems. You ask any computer person out there, your home router has IP address tracking on it. This system did not. So that told us we weren't able to tell who was billing, when they were billing, or where they were billing from. So we went to, Jay and I went to Minit, the state's IT department, and we said, look, we had this is the email that was part I just read to you. We said, we need these IP addresses. Well, we don't really have that, and it's impossible to do that. we need to do that. So after some negotiating, a gentleman over there, a very smart person, set up a temporary IP trap. And he had it, it took him a while, but he was able to trap the IP numbers. And he saw people from Japan logging into our state system to bill for CCAT. And that's all documented. And the evidence is at the DHS lab, and Bennett probably has evidence of it. So that case, because we suspected that lady had ties to terrorism, we could only get her on wire fraud. We couldn't get her on anything more from that because the system wasn't designed to detect fraud.
Thank you. So do you know if the DHS system, that temporary trap was only, I think, up from my reading a couple weeks?
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Yes.
So does DHS now have the capability to track IP addresses?
I do not know. I don't know. After the time, by the time I left, I was told no. But what's happened in the last 7 to 8 years, I don't know.
So why would the system be set up without that ability when it's kind of standard on most computers?
I would be hesitant to give an answer to that.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. All right, I have so many more questions, but we're getting a list here. So Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stillman, can you just confirm, what's the time frame we're talking about here? Like, it sounded like maybe when you left DHS and before, like, can you just talk about what time frame you're describing in terms of wrongdoing?
Representative Pinto, this email is dated April 30th, 2015.
Is Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stillman, I guess I had the impression you were describing wrongdoing besides that time, but is that the only concern you're expressing is about things that happened in April 2015? I guess I had the impression, maybe I'll ask, when did you leave DHS, Mr. Stillman?
I believe it was in 2017. December, I offered my resignation on December 23rd, but I had so much vacation time saved up, I was on the books until March 2018.
Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just clarifying your earlier answer, I guess I had the impression you were indicating that there were concerning things that you saw leading up to all the way when you left at the end of 2017. So is the time frame up until then, or were you, I'm a little confused by your reference to April 2015. I mean, would you see wrongdoing throughout that, you know, up until the end of when you left, or?
I was working there in 2015. I'm not sure I understand your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess maybe what I'm trying to understand is the things that you've described to the committee today, do they all predate when you left? I mean, the things that you saw were while you were at DHS, and that time ended in end of 2017, early 2018. Is that kind of, I'm just trying to fix, understand on the calendar when what you're describing happened. It wasn't last year. It's like when you're at DHS in that time frame. Is that right?
Mr. Stillman.
That is correct. There is one case, the Baraka case, that occurred after I did. I was told by investigators that was a $15 million fraud case, and when they went through the door on the search warrant, they encountered systems of money transfer in there that far exceeded their capability or understanding and scope, and they had to bring in specialists from the Washington, D.C. Secret Services, a special team from there to analyze that.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But it sounds like your firsthand knowledge is from before you left DHS in early 2018. And then it sounded like you were describing, it sounded like you believe that you were essentially forced to resign from DHS, but maybe I misunderstood that. Was that, did you feel like they sort of, you essentially got, you described some pretty bad interactions with management there. Did you feel like you were forced out?
Mr. Stillman.
I do feel I was forced out. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, maybe a question for you then. So I know we've got a lot of materials in the packet. One thing we don't have is the 2019, you referenced it earlier, the 2019 report by the Office of Legislative Auditor. They really reviewed Mr. Stillman's allegations. And in that report, it says that he, so, you know, with all this description of what DHS has, the OLA gets access, and Madam Chair, maybe I'll, I mean, I believe since you've had the OLA in front of the committee, you view them as a very credible source. They found Mr. Stillman didn't respond to interview attempts. Eventually, he had to be subpoenaed. That's on page 2 of the report. They asked for evidence. He didn't provide it. Page 22 of the report. And so when they dug into this, and these are all everything from before 2019, all that he's described, unable to substantiate, that was page 5 of the report. His allegations misleading, page 5, false and unfair, page 28. Said that he was not forced to resign, page 5. And so I guess I'm confused that we're hearing about allegations that were reviewed by the gold standard, our Office of Legislative Auditor, and found that these allegations could not be substantiated. There's no evidence. They dug into the material in DHS's files that are being referenced. So I guess I'm a little confused about sort of what we're doing here these years later when we've actually had these allegations reviewed and when there really is a concern we have to address regarding brought in our state program. So I'm a little confused if you can just clarify that.
Yes, thank you, Lee Pinto. Yes, and I would refer people to the article in your packet from Jim Nobles at the time, the legislative auditor, which he wrote on October 22nd, 2025. And the reason we're kind of covering this old ground is because it goes through sort of the genesis of how the child care fraud started. That led to the money laundering, that led to cash leaving the airport. At that time, my understanding was about, back in 2000, it was about $75 million. It then grew to $84 million. And then most recently, last year, $350 million. And so I'm trying to show members that that this began a long time ago, and it hasn't been adequately dealt with. And just to quote from the legislative auditor's article, just for a minute here, you all have it in your packets. It's also available online to the public if you want to follow along. So at the time in his report, he said they could only prove the $5 to $6 million that had been already prosecuted. So they were not speculating on additional fraud. They relied only on what had been proven in court at the time. And he goes on to say in this, as we know from federal investigations and prosecutions, meaning the subsequent federal prosecutions through the U.S. Attorney's Office in Feeding Our Future, a significant number of people in these organizations were not serving, they were stealing. And then he says the state's negligence allowed people in these sham organizations to continue to use their simple theft scheme repeatedly in child care programs, food programs, housing programs, and the egregious lack of oversight by state officials has deepened public mistrust in government. Less obvious is the fact that some key legislators tried to minimize the fraud problem, and shield the Department of Human Services and the Walz administration from criticism. The then chair of House Human Services Committee at the time of his report, 2019, that House chair dismissed the report and the problem, saying, there's always going to be fraud. And she refused to allow the OLA to present its report to the committee. In addition, the chief House supporter of publicly funded child care subsidies criticized the OLA report for referencing prosecutions that had already proven fraud in the child care program. This person said these references were unnecessary and harmful. And like-minded House members joined in criticizing the OLA for even investigating allegations of fraud in human services program. I, meaning Mr. Nobles, met with Speaker Melissa Hortman. As always, she was thoughtful and supportive of the OLA's work, but acknowledged that some members of her caucus were upset. They felt the OLA reports were subjecting human services programs to too much criticism, particularly programs administered by the Somali community organizations. She did, however, acknowledge that House committee chairs at the time in the DFL-controlled House had been instructed not to give OLA reports about fraud any public hearings. Thankfully, according to Jim Nobles, the OLA at the time, officials, especially at the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI, did not seek to hide Minnesota government fraud problem. They aggressively prosecuted and investigated. So I would like to submit to the public and the committee that the report Mr. Nobles put out at the time in 2019, that the Democrats and the Walz administration tried to bury, as he states in this article, yes, it did criticize and not substantiate everything that Mr. Stillman said. But in hindsight, with all of the court cases we've had, all the prosecutions we've had from Feeding Our Future, he is now saying that we did not do our jobs as a state legislature and that we allowed this to mushroom from childcare to all these other program areas. So I think this is important ground to go back over because it was not gone over at the time.
Well, Madam Chair, just briefly. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not at all dismissing the report that's referenced here. I'm quoting from it. I'm giving credibility to the legislative auditor and to that very report, not dismissing it in the least. I'm quoting from it. And this report found that the witness that you've chosen to bring in to discuss 8-year-old allegations, that those allegations were examined by that same legislative auditor that you are quoting from this op-ed and found that despite a lot of digging, they were unable to substantiate it, found the allegations were misleading, false, unfair, and in fact asked for evidence, and that evidence was not provided. So we're not dismissing the report at all, not dismissing fraud in our programs, wanting to get back to that. So I'm quoting the report, and the report says, hey, we need to get to the issue today, and that's what I'm quoting the report from doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Stillman, for joining us today. I was wondering if you could give us a little more background on how many investigators were with you or worked with you at the time, and did other investigators share the same concerns? I know you came forward, but was there kind of other people who also had these same concerns as you did?
Mr. Stillman.
Thank you for your question. I ran the forensics lab, so I supervised the number varied, but up to three or four people in the lab. Jay Swanson managed the OIG, and he had 11 investigators, highly skilled in bank fraud, surveillance, terrorism, fraud matters, and most of them were from police departments or law enforcement agencies around the state. And all of the investigators shared my concerns, some of them even more. The people who did the bank fraud investigation had some startling revelations about where some of the money was going to. And I would add that the FBI has also been able to substantiate. I mean, I had a hearing, two hearings in 2017. Everything I said was substantiated. Now, when that OLA report came out, I sat down with Jim Nobles. And I said, Jim's a good man, but he had no training in overseas wire transfers, money laundering, frauds of that nature. That should have been an FBI investigation. I don't know why the OLA went to somebody who did a special audit. A special audit is just a small sample audit. They should have gone to a federal agency who had the ability to look at the records. Now, I got a Freedom of Information Act after my hearing, and it's all kinds of statements from the FBI about money going overseas. And I'll give these to Chair Robbins. You can go through them. And then one last thing. If you do want to verify it and you doubt my credibility, go to the DHS and ask them for those records. They're still there.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Altendorf?
No.
Okay, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Stillman, for being here and our additional testifiers as well. Grateful for you all, because at the end of the day, what we're trying to understand is why is so much more money flowing from our airport at a time where we have seen a historic level of fraud, and trying to put together the pieces that are available. So, and understand how to stop it, right? Minnesotans are outraged by this. And further, like, we should be very concerned when our airport sees so much more money leaving our airport than any other across the country, and we're not the largest airport in the country. Like you mentioned, Madam Chair, the 18th largest. So when we're talking about this, and it's $350 million a year, and news story after news story after news story that we all have in front of us that's posted to the committee website talks about how this ends up in East Africa. And so I'm curious, for you first, Mr. Stillman, do you believe that there are people still at DHS who are holding this information, concerned with this information, and sharing it appropriately with federal authorities?
Mr. Stillman.
I have information about that, sir, but because I don't have an attorney here, I think I'm going to pass on answering that question. I think I can say that after the state of Minnesota and the Minnesota Attorney General's office forced me into that lawsuit settlement, it sent a huge chill through the state's investigators. It sent a clear message to them. And I can give you an example of a senior DHS manager who spoke to me and wanted to come forth with some very relevant information that you would love to hear about. And I told this examiner, look, this is what they did to me. And that examiner said, I can't take that risk. I'm not going to come forward.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Mr. Stillman, so along these same lines, and this is the part of your timeline at the very beginning here where I was really curious. So obviously your time at the agency was at the end of the Dayton administration. However, what I thought I heard you play out was that it was the Attorney General's office that had a significant role in, part almost investigating you or pressing you to take certain action. And I'm curious, based upon what you're just saying right here, I'm curious, what was that time frame that you're talking about? Was, because I thought I heard you say it was during 2019. Could you share with the committee when you were forced, or I shouldn't say forced, but pressed into signing a plea agreement by a member of the Attorney General's office?
Mr. Stillman.
You won't use the word forced. I'd say coerced. I'd say forced. I would say this was in August, I believe August 17th of 2017, if my memory serves me correctly. Yes, it was the Attorney General's office that sat me down in a room full of 20 different people over at the Anderson building and said, you are going to do this or we're going to destroy you.
Last question, Representative Schultz, for now.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I was just looking to find out exactly who needs to be held accountable with this. It appears, and it's not just appearance at this point, right? We have seen an exorbitant amount of money go to fraud in the last, it's been going on for a very long time in Minnesota. But the concern is that it continues to increase and enhance. And it doesn't appear like anything that we've heard from anyone who's presented before our committee, Madam Chair, that anything has changed within the executive branch in terms of culture. And, in fact, it's probably gotten worse. So I'm concerned with that. But I'll defer back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I want to, first of all, thank you, Mr. Stillman, for coming forward. And I want to say on the record that over the last 3 months, I have spoken to multiple whistleblowers from the Criminal Investigations Unit that used to exist at DHS, from the financial crimes area, from the money laundering, money transfer area, from maybe a half dozen whistleblowers from that criminal investigations unit. And Mr. Stillman is the only one willing to come publicly and testify. But he speaks on behalf, I have to say, for the other five or so people, maybe more, I've lost track, from that particular unit. So, and I want the public to understand, DHS used to have a criminal investigation unit that did criminal investigations of Medicaid fraud. That was shut down after the OLA reports came out in March and April of 2019. They no longer do criminal investigations in DHS. And at the time, those people testified that they were prohibited from speaking to their counterparts at the BCA without supervisor approval. So there was a clear effort by the new Walz administration to close this down. And that unit no longer exists. Mr. Stillman, is there still a forensic lab at DHS, to your knowledge?
I believe there is, but I couldn't swear to it.
Thank you.
What kind of work they do, I don't know.
Thank you. So and now the financial Minnesota Financial Crimes Unit has been subsumed by BCA, and it still exists. But I would like to just note for the record that their partnership is with the U.S. Postal Service, the U.S. Secret Service, and not with the Department of Treasury. And I guess through the Secret Service, they're adjacent, that's part of Treasury. But their focus has been on identity theft and consumer crimes. It hasn't been focused on the major crimes of fraud that we have been seeing in the last couple of years unveiled here in Minnesota. So, but I just want to thank you, Mr. Stillman, because I know you are speaking on behalf of a lot of people who have also reached out to us, and I know that it's under stressful circumstances. Okay, I would actually, does anyone have questions for Mr. Stillman? Otherwise, I would like to bring the MAC people back up, but if you have questions for Mr. Stillman, we'll proceed.
Yes. Representative Friedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess it's less of a question, but it is after sitting here listening, because I think I share Representative Schultz's outrage when we talk about resources that should be going to vulnerable individuals that are being siphoned off by fraudsters who have made government the mark. What I also find pretty outrageous is that this committee just sat through and is looking at, instead of dismantling, talking about the business model of fraud and dismantling it, instead of talking about changing the incentive structures, instead of talking about how we deal with the vulnerabilities that DHS has, we are talking about 7 or 8 year old discredited allegations and a lot of information that is just like the fact-free zone. I heard a lot of things cited. I heard that MSP has the most money going out the door. I mean, it'd be helpful to see that. It'd also be helpful to see
it's in your packet.
It'd also be helpful to see that, because what we know is going state to state is actually not a federal crime. Going internationally is a federal crime. We don't have the feds here. And so I guess what I would say is the other committees this year are doing serious work on policy. And I, you know, in state gov, in HHS, and I would like us to get back to that about what's happening right now, what has happened over the last 3 or 4 years. I heard you talk about the DHS investigations that have been moved to the BCA. We should be talking about that, the consolidated effort that has been happening at the BCA. We should be talking about the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit and the work that in committee and public safety last year we heard that they are punching above their weight in terms of the size and resources that they have and the criminal investigations and the fraud prosecutions. And that, to me, is how we deal with both the work we need to do here and the outreach we should have, as opposed to what it feels like is trying to launder discredited allegations that are not getting us to the problem solving of how we ensure that these decisions or these services are provided and that we are protecting taxpayer dollars.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. And I would just like to note for the record that I brought 2 new bills to committee based on hearings we've had where we can tighten the internal controls on non-emergency medical transportation, and we would have sanctions for state employees who lie to the OLA. And I shared them with your staff, and I hope we can get bipartisan support on both of those bills. So the work that comes out of these hearings does lead to productive use for the legislature. And we saw that last year when we passed the whistleblower bill and several other bills that came from hearings in our committee. And to your other point, I would just like to say that the reason we are covering some admittedly old ground is because we are establishing that this has been going on in this state since 2020 and beyond. And it has been flagged repeatedly by people at DHS and has not been given the attention it needs until our oversight committee was formed, and we are having to go back over ground because as the OLA said in his op-ed, when the opportunity was presented to go over this, when the OLA first reported in 2019, they were not permitted by committee chairs to testify. So we have to go over old ground because this was not done in real time when it should have been done.
Can I ask, Madam Chair, just one quick question?
Yes, and then we'll go to Representative Elkins, and then I do want to get the MAC back up here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, will you be having the OLA in? Because I guess if I take your point that you feel that the report didn't get adequate attention at the time, then why not have the people who produced the report in? Why have the person who was discredited by the report come in? So wouldn't that make more sense if you want to hear this 2019 report? Let's hear the actual report. We didn't even have the report in our packet and all the materials we have.
So we had it in the packet when we first discussed it last year, but I'm certainly happy to provide it to everyone again. It's also available online at the OLA website.
Okay. And so, Madam Chair, maybe we could have the OLA present if that's such significant concern to you. It just seems like a strange way to bring the report in of the person who was discredited by the report rather than the people who produced the report. Just a suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you. And I do think that one of the points that Mr. Stillman made is still relevant for our work. We need to understand, and I will be sending DHS a letter, if they are currently tracking these IP addresses? Because if they're not, first of all, it would be stunning. But second of all, like, we are flying blind continually. So the testimony today is relevant to our current work to make sure we are doing what we need to hold the agencies accountable. Representative Elkins.
Madam Chair, most of my questions will be better answered when you bring the MAC people back up. But I would point out that a TCP/IP address generally only identifies a location down to about the city level. I don't know how valuable that would be.
Thank you. Well, I will note for the record, and I found this in the court filings regarding this case, that when they set that temporary trap, that is how they knew this woman, who was convicted of wire fraud and served 2 years and had 2 years then of prison time, and she was required to pay restitution. So they found that when they did the two-week trap, that she was charging the state of Minnesota for services from Kenya. So prior to that, they had not found it, and that was revealed in court documents. And so the fact that they were not tracking IP addresses, and I don't know if they still are, but that's something we're going to find out, really is material to being able to prosecute these cases. Thank you, Mr. Stillman. I would like to invite our friends from the Metropolitan Airports Commission to come back to the table. And while they're coming, I want to note for the record that we did invite other people to join us for the hearing, and they declined. So as many people may or may not know, the airport is technically a port, and the jurisdiction is Customs and Border Patrol, and they were invited to come, and they did not come. I also had a lengthy call with the Department of Treasury. I met with Secretary Bessent when he was in Minnesota in January, and I had a call with his team last week, and they were unable to attend, but they did want to outline that they have done a lot, and I think I have that in your packet in the FinCEN document. So a couple things just to highlight Treasury's role in this is that they are currently examining the transfer of funds from Minnesota to other countries around the world. They have been evaluating not only the networks that are used to transfer the money, but the banks behind it and whether they've complied with their legal obligations under the Banking Secrecy Act. They've issued 4 notices of investigation to the money services businesses, which is the technical term MSB for the Hawala networks. They have issued a geographic targeting order requiring banks and money transmitters for Hennepin and Ramsey County to provide additional reports outside of what's already required in the FinCEN 105 form. And by the way, that form is also in your packet. Now, it used to be that they would require the FinCEN 105 form when there were transactions at $10,000 or above. Now, in Hennepin and Ramsey County, they're requiring it every time there's a transaction for $3,000, and the beneficiary is located outside of the outside of the United States. They will be issuing a public report on that and how that's going at the end of this month. They've also issued an alert to financial institutions discussing things that they need to be looking out for, a nexus of, I believe, 11 red flags to help them identify reports and report suspicious activity. So the Department of Treasury is fully engaged in this fight, and we appreciate it. To our friends from the Metropolitan Airports Commission, thank you for coming back up. I think my first question is, clearly there's lines of authority. You have said that your jurisdiction does not go to the money in cash leaving the United States. My understanding from whistleblowers I have talked to is that when a suitcase of cash comes into the airport, could you just describe what happens to that? My understanding is they are screened through TSA, but then they are often taken to a separate room. So is that true? I don't know if it is. And can you just describe? So if I showed up at the airport with $1 million in my suitcase, What would happen to me?
Yeah, again, so TSA does the screening. They would be the first ones that would notice it. The question that when you go overseas, that is something that you have to talk to CBP about, Customs and Border Patrol. They would be the ones that would review the FinCEN 105 form, and they would review the money, and they would talk to you. And again, every time they come back with the same thing, it is the information is accurate, and the process of leaving is legal.
Thank you. And so are those FinCEN 105 forms logged somewhere at the airport? Like, where are they kept?
That is a question you'd have to ask the government, federal government.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, this would be appropriate time for me to ask my question.
Yes, I'll turn to you next, Representative Elkins. And one last question for me. So I have met with retired airport police members, and they have said that their concern, and I would just like you to describe the difference in jurisdiction, that when there's a dog that alerts on cash as they're going through TSA, that even if it's less than 10,000, is treated differently than a suitcase full of $1 million in stacked, wrapped banknotes. So could you describe, the role of the canines and why some cash, even if it's under the amount, flags a different response?
Yeah, Chair Robbins, there's two different things happening. One is the international transfer of funds. The other is currency that's related to illegal drug trafficking. And it isn't that we're out there with canines searching for just cash, right? It is usually we have information about a targeted person and we go in and we can tie that directly back to a drug trafficking organization. So they are completely different. One is the ill-gotten goods from purely illegal activity. The other is the, as the federal government will tell you, the legal transfer of funds out of the country.
And this is where I think we need to get to the nub of it, because if it's drug cartel money, clearly it's illegal. But if it's money stolen from taxpayers, money that's been laundered, it's illegal, but it doesn't seem to be flagged. Can you describe, how do you know cash is illegal for a cartel and cash is not illegal in these other situations that are fraud related?
Yeah, I'm not getting into too many details in a public meeting about how we tie it back to the cartels, but there are systems and information services out there that we utilize. There is essentially a case that's brought against the money, and it's presented by the U.S. Attorney's Office. So it also goes federal. And again, that is different. Now, if there is fraud that's happening and there's ill-gotten goods related to the fraud, it would be on the investigators working that to be able to allocate that and then go after those funds as asset forfeiture, again, through state or federal means. At the airport, that's different, right? We are very involved in the illegal drug trafficking, both on the drugs coming in and the currency going out. We've focused for about the last 5 years on the drugs coming in because of the epidemic of fentanyl. Completely different than the fraud cases. Those are being done on the white collar side. If they were to be able to have a case and ask for our assistance, we would again be able to help them with some things. But I can't attribute money going legally across seas to all fraud. And that would be, again, a question for the federal government and for the agencies doing those investigations.
Thank you. And that's why it's so important to catch it on the front end, because once it's laundered, it technically may look legal to you or to the people who, look at the FinCEN form at the airport. They have no ability to understand the genesis of that cash. Is that accurate?
I can't answer that. I've not looked at the FinCEN forms.
Okay. They're on our website if anyone wants to take a look at them. Representative Elkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it would not be appropriate for me to disclose an open public hearing how I know this, nor would it be for these gentlemen to do so either. But speaking as someone who has done the backroom tour of MSP and watched the process of bags going from the front counter to the airplane, It is completely implausible to me that hundreds of millions of dollars could have made it through that process undetected. Is it impossible?
I'm sorry, so you're disputing that hundreds of millions of dollars have flown out of our airport in cash?
That could not have happened without the TSA's knowledge.
Oh, they're aware. Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, then why aren't they confiscating it?
Because it's technically legal. As long as you fill out a FinCEN Form 105 for amounts over $10,000, it is absolutely legal. And that's what we are trying to make sure the public understands. And if you wouldn't mind, if I could have the retired TSA agent on the Zoom speak to this, do you mind?
So we're saying that this has all been reported.
Yes. And technically, it's legal. But I think the public misunderstands that as long as they fill out the form, it's legal, even though the money may have been laundered. So with your permission, I would like to ask our retired agent to speak to what she has seen go through the airport.
Sounds like a huge gap in federal law.
Yes. We're hoping to get some changes in federal law. Absolutely, okay. Chair Elkins. So do you mind if I return to the agent?
That doesn't sound like our job.
No, but we certainly pressure our federal friends for lots of things. Okay. We sign letters all the time asking them to make changes in federal law that affect our state. So okay. This is an opportunity to do that. To the testifier on the Zoom, are you still there?
Yes.
Would you care to just share in more detail, as a TSA officer, your experience? So someone shows up at TSA with a suitcase full of cash. Obviously, our friends at the airport police say it's not their jurisdiction. It goes to TSA. So what was your duties to deal with cash when it was flagged at the screening?
So how it worked is, you know, every bag goes through x-ray. So as an x-ray tech, you can certainly tell when a bag is full of cash or something dense. Anyway, so they would be pulled. They would go into a private screening room and the suitcase would be opened. And then as a TSA agent, we would just make sure that it was truly a suitcase full of cash. You know, as this testimony goes on and I hear from other people, I really think the money that goes through the airport is on the low end, because we've never actually counted the money. They just fill out that form 105 and get through the airport. So
thank you. So why would they be taken to a private screening room? What's the purpose of that?
So we open up the suitcase and make sure that is just truly cash, not drugs, heaven forbid a water bottle, that it's just truly their millions of dollars of cash.
So do you know?
You know, and to the gentleman that's questioning this, I feel like you're questioning my integrity. I saw it firsthand. There was millions and millions that added to billions and billions of dollars that went through that airport while I worked there.
Thank you. And I'll let you ask one in a second.
I should respond to that, though.
Yes,
I
agree.
I wasn't questioning her integrity. I was saying, I think she does a really good job, and that it would be impossible for somebody to sneak a suitcase full of cash past her and her colleagues.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. I agree. But to your point, I've had, you know, forgotten to take my iPad out of a suitcase, or had different things where my bag has been pulled aside and my bag is opened right there at the end of the belt. So why is cash treated differently? Do you know?
You know, I honestly don't know that. And, you know, I honestly don't know that. But we did. We were instructed to pull it and then bring it to a private screening room. And then a police officer would come, supervision would be there, we'd open the suitcase, and we'd look at it, and we'd let them go. And that's just crazy.
So was the police officer from the Border Patrol, or what type of officer?
No, it was local, MSP.
So would you care to comment on that, Mr. Erickson? Or I'm sorry, either of you?
I'm not aware of that.
Okay. So your officers don't go in the screening rooms?
We have checkpoint officers that respond to any calls at the checkpoint, but in regards specifically to money, I'm not aware of that.
Further comment?
Yeah, to Deputy Chief Erickson's point, we are not called there to do anything. So we will often be called for anomalies and things like that. But just to look at cash, we do not get called for that. It doesn't mean that it hasn't happened in the past. It's just not within the routine course of our business.
It's not routine. Okay, thank you. All right, Representative Schwartz. Schwartz. Sorry, I was misreading the writing on the chair next to me here.
Thank you,
Representative
Madam Chair.
Schultz.
Thank you. Let's all remember here, the reason why we are concerned about this is the level of fraud that we've seen in Minnesota, right? Just if we're just looking at the high-risk Medicaid-funded programs that have likely been over $9 billion stolen in fraud, and now we are learning that there is at least $350 million per year leaving Minnesota heading to East Africa. When you look at Feeding Our Future, 90% of the people who have been indicted have been of Somali descent. And so let's be very clear here, whether it's autism, childcare, ICS, housing stabilization services programs, and we have money leaving this state, it's likely the taxpayers' money, for starters. And so when I'm looking at this and when we're thinking about this to our colleagues across the aisle, that is what we need to be concerned about. We need to be focused upon how we are getting to stop this money from flowing, because it's not happening anywhere else in the country to this level, despite the fact that places like Maine and Ohio and Washington have also been targets along this end. So I have a question for our TSA agent.
Yes.
After they have so my question for you, ma'am, is when you take in this report or this form, you see the money, where does the rest of the information go on the form?
Well, I actually never see the form. You have to understand, I'm just an agent screening hundreds of people a day. Suitcase comes through. We pull it, we go into a private screening room. The instances I've been involved with, we've always called a cop, police officer, to the checkpoint, and they would take a picture of their ID, look at their plane ticket, ask these Somali couriers questions, and we would just open the suitcase, look at their cash, and send them on their way. So that was just my job, to pull the cash, to pull the cash.
Yeah.
Representative Schultz, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other thing that I just want to note for the record is when we have been seeing the stories written about the fraud in Minnesota, the amount of money flowing to East Africa, it's important to also recognize, like, the total picture that we're dealing with here. And one of those points that I want us to see and to know is that, and I'm looking right now at a KSTP report, and this is also with information and estimates, thanks to Dr. Bruce Corey of Concordia University. He's an economist there and has also spent time talking to legislators across the board here in Minnesota, that Somali Minnesotans generate at least $500 million in income annually, and $350 million is leaving our state annually from our airport. That is from his report. And they are a part of $8 billion worth of impact on our state's economy, but $350 million per year is leaving through our airport, and every single one of these documents here that we have in our packets today says that this money is flowing to East Africa. So I'm hoping that through our efforts and maybe continued conversation here, we can find additional tools for the way that we're stopping the flow of taxpayer money out of this state, and to ensure that we're actually helping the people who are in need in our community, in our state, the way that these programs are designed, rather than going to fraudsters of foreign nations.
Thank you. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question also was for the TSA agent. I just wanted a little bit more clarification, and I'm not sure if it's through you, but at what point is the FinCEN, at what point is this filled out or given when we realize that there is a suitcase of cash? And then my question to the TSA agent was, I think this is a really important part that we need to really think about here is, you said the money is never counted. And so I guess I want to know, like, at what point are we filling out the form? And then I'm not sure if it's you, Mr. Christensen, or the TSA agent. Could someone tell me, is it almost always filled out at that 10,000 level, even if it's a big suitcase?
To the testifier on Zoom.
Well, as a TSA agent, I know nothing about this form 105, but I actually went online this weekend and found that form and filled it out. It was quite easy. I said I was bringing $3 million to the airport. And from what I could tell, where it goes, I'm not exactly sure, but you have 72 hours once you fill that out to bring your money through the airport or transport it wherever. So I honestly don't know where that form goes. What I'm telling you is these people are coming through the airport. I'm on the line. I pull the suitcase. We open it up. And we do not count that money. We just, in fact, I can tell you that when we opened it up, the supervisor would in their head do a quick money count, because all the money is banded from the bank, and they would just in their head just then go out and say, oh yeah, I think that was $2 million. So yeah, kind of hokey.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, and just one more clarifying question. Do you know, what were these hundreds, or what size bill were most of these dollars that were going through?
What I saw was usually hundreds.
Okay, thank you. And just
banded. From the bank.
Okay.
Crazy.
And just a final comment then.
I'm sorry, could you restate that last thing you just said? I couldn't hear you to the testifier on Zoom. You said and something?
No, it's just all the money always appeared to be 100s, on the top anyway. And it was all always banded. There were numbers written on it. It was hokey.
Thank you. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe she said from the bank, that it looked like it came directly from the bank. And so again, you know, just following up with why we're here today, and $350 million is actually, that is the number that we have. And that could be much higher based on if people are filling out the form and only putting 10,000. And again, we have record amount of fraud happening in the state of Minnesota right now. It's undeniable. And this is very suspicious and, frankly, very worrisome that the Minnesota taxpayers are this outlier, that we are seeing this high of amount of dollars leaving our airport. And that's why we're here today, is to expose that this cannot be coincidental. I mean, unless your head is just stuck in the sand, this is not coincidental that the fraud is happening in our state, and then we have millions and millions of dollars leaving through our airport, and we're this outlier of all the other states. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, and to the testifier on Zoom again, I just wanted to follow up. So when you would pull the suitcase of cash, you were not given the Form 105 by the courier?
No.
So you did you ever see the Form 105? You would just look at a suitcase of cash and not, it wouldn't be tied to a dollar amount?
Exactly.
I find that stunning.
Because
you and me both.
Yes, maybe the FinCEN form that TSA reported on to get to the $350 million is based on the form submitted. But in fact, it could be higher, to Representative Altendorf's point. If the form is not required to be presented or looked up online, because I know you can submit them online, as the cash is moving through, how do you verify that the identities of the people are the ones tied to the form? I know these are not questions for you. They're questions for Treasury, and we will be sending them a list of these questions afterwards. But I find that stunning, and clearly an important gap in the process. So I did want to go through, just before we wrap up here, something that the Treasury Department sent, and I believe it's in your packets. It's about their alert that they sent. And if not, I'll make sure we make it available. Yes, it is. It's in your packet, the FinCEN alert. And they are talking about what they see. And members, this is a document from January 9th of 2026. This isn't old news. This is happening in our airport today. And how they are trying to cut down, to Representative Altendorf's point, on the fraud. Because as the MAC people have testified, when the money comes from a bank and people claim it is their own, we have failed because we haven't stopped the money laundering. And once it gets in their bank account and they can transfer it, that's where we lose the opportunity to stop the outflow of fraud taxpayer money from our state. So what they're finding is, as they said, that this is relevant to just the ones they're tracking with Feeding Our Future and other federal nutrition program site sponsors, that the complicit site sponsors use multiple methods to launder the money. So this is where we as the state have to get on top of this. The wire transfers through banks to U.S. and foreign located individuals and recently established shell companies under their control. Wire transfers through banks to virtual asset service providers for purchase of digital assets. International wire transfers allegedly for personal remittances via money services businesses, which are the hawalas, and purchases and redemptions of cashier's checks. And they, members, when you look at the court documents in the Feeding Our Future cases to date, it shows multiple of these wire transfers. That's why a lot of them are convicted on wire fraud, and also the purchases of high-value property, vehicles, planes, trips to expenses and international resorts, residential, commercial, real estate, luxury goods, and cars. So these are things that we are trying to stop in real time, and I invite my colleagues into how we can do a better job of catching this on the front end, because once the money that's stolen through, that was identified previously by Mr. Stillman and his colleagues, of seeing those wire transfers or those bank transfers where it's multiple banks getting money the same day, once that's happening locally, I had a whistleblower tell me on the phone a couple weeks ago how they used to see, when they were investigating this and they had access to the bank records, that they would see a deposit of, say, $15,000 at a certain bank branch. And then they'd go to a different bank branch and withdraw it. And then they'd go to a different bank branch and deposit it. Or they would deposit it to one of their shell companies, which is normally a food service provider, or another daycare, or another autism center, and they would pay each other consulting fees. So there is sort of a chain we can identify here, and if we can catch that on the front end before it gets in a wire transfer or a hawala transfer out of the country, or cash in a suitcase, that's where we need to tighten it up at the state level. So, these are things that the Treasury Department is working on in real time, and we're grateful for their help. We're grateful for the role of the Metropolitan Airports Police, grateful for the role of the TSA. But we need to do our jobs to
find this on the front end. Otherwise, it's very hard to say once they fill it out on a FinCEN 10 form that it's illegal. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, so as I listen to this, what I'm hearing is a complete failure on the part of the Trump administration, both the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Treasury, to enforce the federal anti-money laundering statutes, which doesn't surprise me completely given that so far across his two terms, President Trump has pardoned 70 fraudsters, including people who have been convicted of up to $1.2 billion in Medicare and Medicaid fraud. In the case of one person named Philip Esformis, had his sentence commuted because he had devoted his time in prison to prayer and repentance. So that the notion that we should be lectured by the federal government right now about fraud prevention is just, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sorry, Representative Elkins, you feel that way, because I think Treasury has stepped up in a significant way by limiting the amounts, by having a whistleblower program. I wanted to highlight that for the public as well. The Treasury Department has set up a whistleblower program where you can submit a tip if you go to FinCEN.gov, FinCEN.gov, and you can submit tips and they will compensate you if the tips show bear out truth. And I would remind everyone that the bulk of this fraud was going on under the Biden administration when they did not have any of these programs in place. The Trump administration came in and decided that they're going to crack down, and I'm grateful for their help. But clearly, hundreds of millions, billions have gone out of this airport, and the fraud that was perpetrated during the Feeding Our Future years, that was all during the Biden administration, just to be clear. And we'll get into this later, but a lot of the fraud was enabled by the Meals Act, which was passed by Representative Ilhan Omar, and it took all the guardrails off the school nutrition program so that they could now not need to check eligibility for the program. They didn't have to, they could use restaurants for food sites for the first time in the program. So that's what led to a lot of the fraud that we're seeing now in the Feeding Our Future program. So I would just submit that that there's a lot of blame to go around. And I'm grateful for the efforts that everyone is now doing to get after it. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, piggybacking off of that, let's talk about the last two administrations. Let's talk about the flood of illegal immigrants into our country. Let's talk about the huge levels of public service, human services fraud that has been seen in Minnesota and across our country. And let's talk about people who are doing something about it. This committee, you know, we took a vote last week to repeal housing stabilization after we shut that program down. Much thanks to our attention on this. If you remember, non-emergency medical transportation has seen a steep decrease ever since this committee was created. And as it relates to the Department of Treasury, I went and looked, and President Biden's Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, visited Minneapolis to talk about housing rather than to talk about fraud and waste and abuse, which is exactly what Secretary Bessent did when he came here. And this attention and this focus is incredibly important. And if we want to talk for a moment about what I'm grateful for, it's this incredible level of support that we have received on attention to fraud in Minnesota, and the fact that there remain 500 federal Department of Homeland Security officials investigating the fraud in Minnesota today. We are on March 23rd, and they have not left our state. They are doing good work, and I have to assume that their investigations, while they take time, will amount to ending and stopping the fraud here in Minnesota. And certainly there is more work to do, which why, Madam Chair, I want to thank you for having this hearing so that we can shed greater light to this issue and inform our federal policymakers while President Trump and Republicans in Washington have the chance to pass reforms to protect the public's money. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I think about folks who you said those Homeland Security agents have not left our state, folks who have left, a reminder, is more than half of the prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and they really were leading the charge in fighting fraud. And Madam Chair, as long as we were discussing so many federal issues, I guess I really would encourage you to have a hearing regarding the presidential pardon power. We can look at how it's been used over multiple administrations. I completely credit what Representative Elkins had to say regarding President Trump having having pardoned multiple fraudsters. Here's a concern that I have, is that when we identify fraud in our public programs, we want to make sure that we have prosecutors who can go after that fraud. Because of the action of the Trump administration, we've now lost tons and tons of federal prosecutors in our state and have been very much set back, according to Joe Thompson and others, who we've quoted quite with a lot of credibility here in this committee. So we're set back on that. And then if we end up getting a conviction, there's a significant risk, depending on the connections of the person that we've gone after, President Trump is going to pardon them anyway. So I really, as long as we've gotten into these issues, you, Madam Chair, you referenced the connection of remittances, is that maybe we want to get a change in federal law relating to that. Well, we should look at other changes in our federal practices and laws as well, and at the very least have an examination of how they're being used, starting with the presidential pardon power. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lead Pinto. And I would just like to wrap by saying, first of all, thank you to our testifiers, Mr. Christensen, Mr. Erickson from the Minneapolis Airports Commission, and Mr. Stillman, our testifier online. We appreciate your contributions to this discussion, and we will follow up on the items we discussed where we saw gaps, and we will encourage our federal partners to close those gaps and to do even more. We're grateful for the work of Treasury in what they're already doing here on the ground, but we also invite more help. And to your point, Lead Pinto, I just wanted to close with this. So Joe Thompson has been a tremendous asset to this state in prosecuting fraud under the Biden administration and the Trump administration, and we are very grateful for the work he and his team did. I would note that under new U.S. Attorney Rosen, they are back to staff, and I have talked with both the new first U.S. Attorney, Joe Tarab, and his deputies, and they are doing great work. They are continuing, as we saw last week, to get new convictions and plea deals, and new indictments are forthcoming, and there will be another trial in April. And I would say that the biggest problem I have seen locally is that we had a unanimous jury verdict that was thrown out by a judge. And so I think if we have some concerns about how these cases are being handled at the end, when we finally do get a conviction, a judge throwing out a unanimous jury verdict is part of the problem why people are losing faith in the system. And it is up to us members, bipartisanly, to continue this work, to expose fraud, to find the gaps in statute and the gaps in policy that we need to tighten up, to have the oversight hearings that were not done in previous legislatures, and to work with our federal partners as needed, because we are not going to solve this on our own. Once it becomes an international wire transfer, we need partnership with our federal partners, and I look forward to continuing all of these conversations and continuing the work to stop the fraud in Minnesota. Thank you. We are adjourned.